Welcome to the Friday, June 7th post-primary episode of On Iowa Politics. On this week's podcast, we talk about Tuesday's primary election results, of course, and maybe get a little bit into that news out of NYC that broke just after we taped last week's podcast. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. After a skeleton crew last week, we got the whole gang back together for you to talk about the election. With me this week, our Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief, Tom Barton. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Aaron.
Lead Des Moines Bureau Chief, Caleb McCullough, is back. Hello, Caleb.
Aaron, I've been on vacation, so any sort of court verdict or election that you might speak of, no idea what you're talking about. Sorry.
I'm actually not familiar either. I'm going to Google that while we move on here. Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times is with us. Hello, Sarah.
Afternoon, Aaron.
We have Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal as well. Hello, Jared.
Less than 5 months until Election Day, Aaron.
Ooh. And finally, Gazette columnist Todd Dorman is here. Hello, Todd.
Hello, Aaron. And I just like to say that this podcast is a sham. It's just a disgraceful sham.
Okay. I'm trying to say this without getting myself in trouble here. I have not been able to stop thinking about, and this is not a commentary on anyone or anything or any party or any strategy, but I cannot stop thinking about that old... Todd, this may be another one where you may be the only one who remembers this, unless it's managed to stay in the ether. For the youngs to recognize it, the old, I think it was Bud Light commercial when it was during an election year and they did the presidential debate. And it was Bob Odenkirk playing one of the candidates. And he said, "This is a travesty and a sham and a mockery."
The travesty mockery.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. If you haven't, by the way, on your YouTubes and look up that commercial. It's hilarious.
Somebody should have used that, Travis. Scam mockery.
Those words were thrown about so much late last week that I could not get that commercial out of my head.
Those were the good old days when we would get like two new like memes or what were basically memes a year, and they would come around like Super Bowl time, and that was it. There were no more like funny new things for the year. That was your allotment.
That's a golden one. All right. Let's get right into it to dive into these election results from Tuesday night's primary election here in Iowa. We talked last week about some of the specific elections we were watching, and I think each one of those results did turn out to be pretty interesting. So let's discuss those here. And Sarah, we'll let you start. Tell us about that first district Republican primary. It's got a little theme here. I think we're going to hear today of elections that were maybe a little bit closer than we expected.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that was definitely the story in the first district. So Marionette Miller Meeks, the incumbent, won 55% to Pouch's about 44%, like just shy of 44%. And so there were about, it's surprising, I think, in part because David Pouch, he's a Quad Cities prayer breakfast organizer. He's not super well known outside of the Quad Cities, but he has networked by organizing that pretty big event, had speakers like Carrie Lake, Mike Lindell. So he has connections in that way and through his ministry, but he only raised about $35,000 in the period starting January 1st, 2023, whereas Marionette Miller Meeks raised about $2.9 million and spent about $1.3 million of that, according to the most recent campaign finance. So not a super well-funded challenge. Marionette Miller Meeks had endorsements from Governor Kim Reynolds and Brenna Byrd, but Pouch was just very, very passionate about his position as a more conservative candidate than Marionette Miller Meeks. Really took issue with several of her votes, including one for the her support for the Respect for Marriage Act and its protections for same-sex marriages, and at least two Central Committee county organizations censured her over that vote. So it's interesting, like, if you look at the results in 2022 with several top-of-the-ticket races for governor, Senate, all the executive offices. Marionette Miller Meeks had about 41,000 votes for her, even though she was unopposed. And so then for this race, there were less than 30,000 votes. And so I talked with one political science professor who pointed to that low turnout for the race as one factor of many that potentially helped fuel David Pouch's better than expected results. If, you know, he's the underdog in the race, his supporters are very passionate and want to turn out for him. Whereas Marionette Miller Meeks, maybe her supporters are a little more casual. They'll come out for those top of the ticket races, but maybe felt like she had it in the bag, didn't feel that same sense of urgency to come out and vote for her. And yeah, and then also I want to say that Democrats, so Christina Bohannon sets up a challenge with Christina Bohannon in the first district in November, rematch between Marionette Miller Meeks and Christina Bohannon, and her campaign, the DCCC, former seat holder Dave Loebsack really pointed to Marionette Miller Meeks's the closer than expected result as a sign of weakness for the general election, that, okay, if she can't, you know, totally button down this Republican primary, maybe she'll experience some trouble in the general election. But the political science professor I spoke to was a little more skeptical of that. Those David Pouch supporters he thought would vote, assuming they would vote for Miller Meeks instead of Christina Bohannon, and that really the indicator is going to be how no party voters feel about each of the candidates and what's going to happen between Trump and Biden as we get to November is probably going to drive that conversation more than individual conversations in the district.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing within that, Sarah, and forgive me, I don't think I heard this. David Pouch won Scott County. Correct?
Do I remember? Barely.
Yeah.
Or no. No, I think
I'm sorry.
Unofficial results. It was like 50% to 50%.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think Marionette Miller Meeks had like less than 10 more votes. Like it was a very, very small margin. And so that's unofficial results. So it could have gone either way. But the important part is that it was very, very close. And I think he did pull out ahead in Clinton County, which is just north of us.
Yeah.
Was pretty even in most of the other counties, except for there was one close to Des Moines that was more heavily toward Miller Meeks. But yeah, so yeah, that was, we weren't sure what to expect. AP called the race, I mean, right after Scott County dropped all their votes. They dropped all their votes at like 10 p.m. And I think they were the last county to report any results. And so all of those votes came in and then AP called the race.
Interesting.
If I got the right number, it was 6 votes.
That's ironic. That's
no. Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
At least the one I saw is 2,781 for Pouch and 2,775 for Miller Meeks.
Oh wow. So she's on the other side of the 6 vote difference this time. How about that?
A visceral flashback right now to
that. Right? That's incredible.
Was it 2020?
2020, right? Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully, that was just one county and not the whole district, and we won't have to deal with the endless recounts and shenanigans. Oh, my goodness.
Just to build off of what Sarah said, it seems kind of one factor that was probably most relevant in this primary race in the first congressional district is that David Pouch is a Donald Trump loyalist and a 2020 election denier. I believe he disputes that January 6th was an insurrection, you know, said that Biden essentially is an illegitimate president, that he never would have voted to certify the 2020 election results as Marionette Miller Meeks did. And I wonder, you know, how much that kind of factored in here, you know, given kind of the low voter turnout, you know, kind of the lack of enthusiasm, the fact that you didn't have, you know, a statewide race at the top of the ticket, you know, you didn't have you didn't have the governor on the ballot. You didn't have, a U.S. Senate seat on there. And, you know, the fact that Miller Meeks didn't endorse a candidate before the 2024 Iowa caucuses, and you know, didn't really kind of jump on to support Trump in his campaign until after, you know, his big win here in the Iowa caucuses.
You're stealing one of my points, Tom. You're stealing one of my points.
I'll throw it to you. Go ahead.
I'll let Aaron go first.
Well, no,
finish us out here.
Right at 20%, Kevin Virgil was, right, Jared, in the 4th District?
Yep, behind Randy Feenstra. And yeah, I guess skipping ahead to the one of the points I was going to make about driving this race, the pipeline is one of them here, obviously. And Kevin Virgil hammered that a lot, going as far as repeatedly calling out Bruce Rastetter by name, who has spearheaded the Summit Carbon Solution Project. At a rural issues forum from like last week, Virgil went after Rastetter, as well as companies like Smithfield and Tyson, which always makes your ears perk up in this part of the state when a politician is being that forceful about major companies like that. You don't necessarily always hear that at those kind of forums. And then, yeah, the other issue that I think does relate to what Tom was saying is that in our district, Feenstra never made an endorsement before the caucuses. And that rankled some people because there are parts of the base that see a non-endorsement as a kind of disloyalty to Trump.
Well, that's how Trump sees it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we saw that with Governor Reynolds, right?
Yeah.
Meeks, I believe she was not endorsed by Trump in her reelection campaign for 2022. She was like the only Republican in Iowa. And I'll double check this.
And that was because of the infrastructure.
No, her initial vote for the January 6th commission.
Oh, that's thank you. Yep.
Yeah. Eventually she voted against the final one, but the bipartisan one she had voted for.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
That's right. Thank you. Jared, did you have any more to tell us about Virgil?
Did I?
Yeah. Take off, man.
Yeah, so, you know, the night started off with Feenstra doing very, very well. Like, when we got the first batch of votes in, he was more than double up on Kevin Virgil. And by the time we had a quarter of the counties fully reporting, Feenstra was still above 25 points. But then things started fluctuating more, and at one point the number dipped to about 16 points, which is about as low as it got, if I can remember. I kept doing a lot of frantic tallying that then had to be erased and immediately like changed in real time, which is always very annoying when there are a bunch of counties that get officially reported at the same time. And then eventually the number kind of finally stabilized at about 20 points. And there were some very notable county results for Kevin Virgil. He won Plymouth County, which is where Lamar's is and borders Feenstra's home county. Virgil won that by about 15 points. He won Osceola County, which also borders Sioux County, where Randy Feenstra's from. He won that by 13 points. He won Hancock County in North Central Iowa by 25 points. Those were some of the biggest ones that he had. And then Feenstra really, and like some of these margins are certainly what helped him ultimately get around 20 points ahead of Virgil. He won Webster County by 50 points. And he also won Crawford County, which is former Representative Steve King's county, by 13 points. And the Feenstra staffers were touting that on Twitter as it was happening. They were really relishing in winning the county that Steve King's in. And once the win was kind of obvious, Feenstra's campaign put out a statement saying, tonight Iowans sent a clear message that they want a conservative voice in Congress, who delivers results for our families, farmers, businesses, and our rural communities, which Kevin Virgil and Steve King did not see it that way. Virgil on Twitter said, Iowa sent a clear message tonight. Yes, that message is that 40% of hashtag IA04 voted against him and in favor of a challenger with zero name recognition who only entered the race 5 months ago tonight. And then Virgil finished that tweet with, we've learned a lot, and in 2026, we are going to win. And then Wednesday morning, excuse me, Steve King tweeted about going rhino hunting, R-I-N-O, in 2026. So I think that's a preview of 2026, and I think with 2 years' time, higher name ID, and more money, Virgil could make the race even a little more interesting still.
That'll be interesting. Well, and hey, look, Randy Feenstra is in Congress because he won a Republican primary against an incumbent congressman. So who just happens to be Steve King, by the way. So obviously it can and very recently has happened there.
And one last thing I should note, just like Sarah's district, we're also going to be getting a rematch in the fall because Randy Feenstra will again be facing Democrat Ryan Melton.
And unlike Sarah's district, that fourth district general election race promises to probably not be very close, if history is any indication.
Yeah, history has not been kind.
Yeah. Todd, let me ask you real quick here, as you look at these two results collectively, should, in looking ahead to the general election, should Marionette Miller Meeks and Randy Feenstra / Iowa congressional Republicans be concerned about those primary results, and do they portend anything at all to the general election, or are these unique beasts that really don't give us an indication of what might happen in November?
Well, you're right. They do portend that a general election will happen. So that's one thing we know for sure. November 5th.
I love it when you go out on a limb, Todd. I really appreciate November 5th. You sticking your neck out there.
Don't miss it. Don't miss it. Feenstra isn't in any trouble. I mean, people forget, and really no one made a very big deal out of it, but you know, Grassley had a lesser known primary challenger. I guess that'd be 2 years ago, 2022.
Jim Carlin got 26%.
Almost 30% of the vote. Yep. And so there's there's sort of an insurgent group of Republicans out there that think these conservatives are not conservative enough, and none of them are going to vote for Ryan Melton. And with Trump on the ballot, the idea that they might stay home is pretty far-fetched. Also, Marionette Miller Meeks is going to have a tougher race just because of the district makeup, and the Democratic Party is actually putting some money into the district. And I mean, Bohannon, lost to her before, but and it's unusual to come back later and win, but it's not impossible. And I think she's a fairly decent candidate. So,
again, similar to the last qualifier, Marionette Miller Meeks is an example of someone who has lost it. You're right, it's rare, but we have a very recent example.
Yeah, that was her fourth time, wasn't it? When she
fourth
finally
time
won,
was the charm. Yeah.
So, Bohannon. Pat Buchanan, I'm back in 1996, 92. She's going to, she definitely needs to line up the last six voters, when she's out campaigning, just change the mind of six right at the end so that you don't lose by six. I think that's a good strategy. But... It was not an exciting primary night.
No, I mean, there at the end of the day, and this leads perfectly into, Tom, what I want to ask you about next in the statehouse primaries. At the end of the day, the intrigue was just how the close calls, essentially, right? And to whatever degrees these were actually, they weren't technically close calls. They were just closer margins than maybe we expected. There were actually some close calls in the statehouse primaries, though, weren't there, Tom? And we talked about a couple that were interesting because of, I don't want to call them single issue races, but certainly campaigns where one issue was very much at the forefront. In some incumbents, I imagine had a couple of moments of maybe perspiration Tuesday night, but ultimately hung on, it looks like.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we really didn't have many close races in our coverage area here in Eastern Iowa, which is what I was paying most attention to. But you talked about some of these primary races, you know, have centered on a, you know, one particular issue, be that the issue of eminent domain and the carbon capture pipelines, or abortion. So one race that I thought was pretty interesting was incumbent state senator Waylon Brown, a Republican from Osage. He ended up winning his race for Senate District 30, which represents Mason City, Northwood, Osage area. He faced a challenge from Doug Campbell, who advocated against eminent domain and carbon capture pipelines. He made that kind of a focal point, again, of his campaign. Senator Brown, according to unofficial results, I think, walked away with roughly 53% of the vote to Campbell's 47%. So, you know, not a huge margin, you know, that was, it was pretty close. And Senator Brown, I think, goes on to face a Democrat. Is it Richard Lawrence in the general election? I think that's right.
I'll look that up as you keep going.
Right. Race in our neck of the woods that I was paying more attention to is a state house race. It was a Republican primary for the seat that's currently held by State Representative Brad Sherman, a Republican from Williamsburg, who has decided not to seek re-election. So you had two Republicans running in the primary for that open seat. You had Williamsburg Mayor Adam Greer, and my apologies if I mispronounced that name, and political newcomer Judd Lawler, who was recruited and endorsed by Brad Sherman to run for that seat. Lawler ended up walking away victorious Tuesday night. He ended up walking away with about 79% of the vote to Greer's 21%. Lawler, he's a Johnson County native and a former federal prosecutor in New York, talked about how he ran to continue State Representative Brad Sherman's work of strengthening families, protecting individual liberty, particularly on issues involving property rights. And regarding the latter, he said that he supports legislation restricting eminent domain use for these carbon capture pipelines in the state.
And you are right. Richard Lawrence of Mason City will be the Democrat in that district, which I believe is a fairly Republican. I can't be quoted on that, so forgive me if I'm way off, but I believe that's a fairly safe Republican district.
I think it is. And on that district, I last week wrote a little bit about the fundraising going on and the spending going on in that district, and that was the most expensive legislative race of this year. And obviously Senate races are generally going to be more expensive than House races, but it was more than any other Senate race. So, and that was mostly on spending and raising by Waylon Brown. So he, in this last period before the election, spent five times more. He spent about $55,000 than his opponent, Doug Campbell, and, you know, still came within that couple hundred votes there. And he had raised more than $150,000. So it was a very, very competitive race, and it was very much one of those where the challenger, even with that cash disadvantage, had a pretty solid amount of support.
We kind of said that on last week's podcast. We're going to find out how much juice this issue has as a poll the bar topic. And I remember now, as we sit here on Iowa Press, every year we have the different leaders, legislative leaders, on after the session. And when we had the two Republican leaders on, Amy Sinclair and Pat Grassley, we asked each one, and it was, in fairness, sort of a crystal ball question, but we asked, you know, what's your prediction on whether eminent domain is an issue that will hurt your party's candidates that don't, you know, support legislation to restrict the use of eminent domain, and we kind of got our answer, didn't we? I mean, it made this. I mean, it was still a 6-point win for the incumbent. He held on, but as Caleb noted, you know, despite being massively outspent and being a challenger and against an incumbent to come within 6 points, I think it's and then again what Kevin Virgil did with Randy Feenstra in the fourth district similarly kind of shows that one packs a little bit of a punch. The other one, just to put a bow on what we talked about last week, I think we talked about Jane Bloomingdale's race as well, and she was able to survive a little more comfortably. Her primary challenger was endorsed by the family leader, and she had voted against the original 2018 fetal heartbeat bill. She won by a 60-40 margin by about 600 votes in her primary, so she didn't have quite as white knuckle a night as Waylon Brown did.
One of the closest ones, just on the outer edge of our coverage area, House District 7, incumbent Mike Sexton survived a primary challenge from Wendy Lou Larson. He won by 55 votes.
I saw that one. Yep. Do you have any insight into that race, Jared? I had no idea that one was going to be close.
Not a lot, because like I said, it's on the outer fringes of what our coverage area is. But at least on Wendy Lou Larson's website, the bulletin points she had for Things I Stand For, pro-life, pro-family, pro-Second Amendment, less government, more freedom, no foreign land ownership, and against the CO2 pipeline.
There you go. Yeah. That's and I'm trying to remember, this is terrible, Tom or Caleb, do you remember whether Mike Sexton was where he voted on those bills in the House? I don't know why we would
not off the top of my head.
I can't think.
We'll have to look that up and update you on next week's episode, or maybe if I can get someone wound up here long enough, I can check it while we're still. Stay tuned. All right. For the benefit of the body, anybody else have anything primary election related before we move on here? I don't see.
I was just going to circle back with my fact check. So it looked like out of incumbents running in 2022, Marionette Miller Meeks was the only Republican that did not get an endorsement.
There you go. Okay. Good one. There you go. All right. So another item we want to make sure we cover this week, and it probably seems like old news at this point to y'all listening, but this one broke like literally within minutes after we finished recording last week's podcast. I remember closing down shop here, and by the time I made it back to the house and popped my computer back on, the news had broken. And that, of course, is the conviction on all 34 counts in former President Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York. We're not going to try here, especially a week later, to break through the cacophony of, did I pronounce that right? Of hot takes. We'll do here what we do at the On Iowa Politics podcast best, and that is talk about how this is playing out in Iowa. And there have been some interesting developments on that front. So Tom, get us rolling here. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst has taken a legislative stand, joining some of her Senate colleagues in defense of the former president. Tell us about that.
Pronounced cacophony, I believe.
Cacophony. Thank you. All
right. Anyway, so as you mentioned, Iowa GOP Senator Joni Ernst joined conservative colleagues in vowing to oppose Democratic legislation and not confirm judicial and political appointees nominated by Democratic President Joe Biden to protest former President Donald Trump's recent felony convictions in that New York hush money trial. Senator Ernst signed on to a letter along with 10 other Republican senators, again, promising to oppose any increases in non-security related funding. Again, any of President Biden's judicial and political nominations, vowed to oppose any expedited consideration and passage of Democratic legislation. The letter was written by Republican Utah Senator Mike Lee. And in it, it talked about, they assert that the White House has made a mockery of the rule of law. And
there's that word again.
Altered our politics in un-American ways.
Yep. There's that mockery word again. That's why I can't shake that commercial. Todd, this is a fairly safe play for Senator Ernst. Well, hold on. Let me, Tom, do you have this, like, the statement right in front of you, or maybe just your coverage? Because I'm wondering if Senator Ernst had addressed in any way, because the easy fireback on this is that this was a state prosecution, a state level prosecution. This happened in the state of New York, grand jury, jury trial. It really had nothing to do with the federal government or the DOJ. Does Senator Ernst's statement address that in any way?
So Senator Ernst didn't really put out a statement. There's the letter that she signed on to, and you know, the letter doesn't specifically address that. It just says that as a Senate Republican conference, we are unwilling to aid and abet this White House in its project to tear this country apart, the senators wrote. And on social media, Senator Ernst, you know, has, you know, essentially reiterated those Republican talking points, or, you know, the assertion that they feel that this was politically orchestrated by President Biden's administration, and that former President Trump's conviction and prosecution amounts to political persecution. And Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson reiterated that on Friday, speaking to reporters during her weekly news conference, claiming without evidence that the trial in New York was, designed to keep Trump off the campaign trail, and that it was orchestrated by President Biden. She said that, you know, quote, "The only thing I believe President Trump was guilty of here is being named Donald Trump." You know, it's worth pointing out that this was a state level case. You know, this wasn't being prosecuted by the DOJ. Trump was indicted by a grand jury and convicted by a jury of his peers following a 5-week trial, listening to testimony and considering evidence. I think they heard from 22 witnesses during this jury trial. And, you know, as I mentioned, you had a 12-member jury decide that, you know, after, again, listening to all of the testimony, that, they deemed that the evidence was sufficient to rule him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But Hinton, as well as other Republicans, note that Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, a Democrat, campaigned for office in 2021 in part on his qualifications to take over the office's investigation into Trump. The judge in the case donated, a very small amount, I think $15.
I was just going to say it was literally like 15 bucks.
To Biden in 2020. And he has a daughter who works in Democratic politics, though he said neither affected his ability to be impartial. Prosecutor, I think, joined Bragg's office after serving in the Biden administration's Department of Justice. Again, though, you know, that's not necessarily direct evidence to support or substantiate a claim saying that, you know, that Biden was, you know, pulling the strings in this case and in this trial.
Todd, so you had all of the Iowa Republicans coming to Trump's defense immediately afterwards, and that's not necessarily surprising. This Ernst joining this letter and pledging to oppose nominees, et cetera, et cetera, that's going another step further. But I suppose even that isn't any kind of dangerous move politically for her here in Iowa, is it? I mean, first of all, she's not on the ballot again for 4 more years, or 2 more years. 2 more years, and Iowa, you know, being the voting demographic it is, is there any downside to Senator Ernst here?
Probably not. And I mean, at least some of that they're threatening sounds like, you know, business as usual. I mean, you know, Republicans are in the they're not exactly,
that's a good point.
They haven't exactly been a big help to the Democratic majority getting stuff done. Again, their guy gets convicted or something politically he gets harmed, he gets damaged. And so they decide, well, it's more important for us to stand up for him than to, you know, allow the president elected by the American people and the Senate elected by the American people to do any of the people's business. We have to put that all on hold so that everyone knows how loyal we are to Donald Trump. It's like, well, maybe that's why I once put her in Washington. Although, you know, I don't know, but it seems like, you know, maybe this idea that you have to move heaven and earth just to prove that you're loyal to this guy it gets pretty comical after a while. And he can't lose. He can't lose in the courtroom. He can't lose an election. I mean, you get tired of all the not losing, I guess.
That's a new way to, that's a new spin on the phrase right there. Tired of all the not losing. All right. Well, and that's going to be it for the legal stuff. It's from what it sounds like to me, before the election, like all the other cases are getting delayed, and even this appeal. Forgive me if I'm wrong. Someone check me if I'm wrong. I've heard that that'll take months and won't be decided before the election. So
it's weird that the president can't orchestrate this so that those go to trial, and he could have orchestrated like moving Hunter Biden's trial till after the election. I mean, as long as you're going to be orchestrating all this, you might as well go, you know,
kind of like all those ballots from 2020, right? That helped Joe Biden, but no other Democrat down ticket on any of those.
And apparently he orchestrates all this stuff in the short time every day where, you know, he's awake and knows where he is and stuff. Because, I mean, we're expected to believe that he's an evil mastermind, and he's got
and a feeble old man.
He's a feeble old man with like dementia or something. So it's
got a real Jekyll and Hyde thing going on there for him.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, you got Dark Brandon. I guess that's who's calling the shots on this.
All right, that'll do it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice or on the YouTubes, where you should also smash that like button. You can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette and Lee website. And now that you listen to the On Iowa Politics, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter, and you get every penny's worth, at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. Ooh, the Waterloo folks would have been so upset if I put Cedar Falls first in that paper's name.
Don't cross Waterloo, Aaron.
Free by Tone DeBoss is playing us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. We'd love to round it out. For the whole gang, Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Sarah Watson, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, and our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for joining us. Let's make moves. Time for a selfie. Let's take two. Still got my job, so I'm thankful. Am I super fly? Let me make sure.
Ladies that inspire, impact, and are making a difference across Eastern Iowa. That's Her Women of Achievement, an annual community celebration recognizing 13 outstanding women who are leading in unique ways. Join the Gazette for the June 13th celebration with keynote Clarissa Chun of the University of Iowa women's wrestling team. Find full details at her.today. That's her.today.